For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away in the lust of it. But he who does the will of God abides forever. John here breaks the world up into three categories. He tells us they are not from God. In chapter 2 and verse 15, he says, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him." We cannot have the love of the world in our lives and love God. There's not room for both. If we're going to love God, we must take those things in the world and drive them out of our lives. And why wouldn't we? As John points out here in 1 John, he says, the world is passing away and the lust of it. All those things, the lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and pride of life, those things are passing away. They will not continue. So why waste our times on them when they're counter to those who love the Father and do the will of the Father, and those who do abide forever? Think about pride. Pride of life. Pride in oneself. He says it's passing away, and of course it is. When we all stand before God's glory at judgment and behold the greatness of God, pride will die right then. There's no room for us to think anything of ourselves as we stand there before God. Pride is passing away. It's pointless. We stand before God already. We should already cast it out. I want to take the first bit, and probably the most bit of my time this morning, focusing on pride of those three categories. Because pride is everywhere in our society. Pride runs rampant. Pride works its way in to philosophies and wisdoms and good things. Things that men hold up as this is a strong good thing. It's all based on it's based on pride. It wedges its way in. And if we're to be in the world, not of the world, but in the world, and around those teaching people, and around these people fishing for men, we will be around this pride. We'll be around these theories and philosophies of men. And I want to take a moment and point out how subtle but prevalent pride is. We read of the obvious dangers of it all throughout the Bible. There's the many a familiar passages. Proverbs 13:10 reads, "By pride comes nothing but strife, but with the well-advised is wisdom." Proverbs 16:18 says, "Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall." In 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 12, it says, "Therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he falls." The danger of pride is laid out throughout the Bible. And yet we let it enter in and weasel its way into our theories. We must recognize it, call it what it is, so that we can treat it, cast it out, and not succumb to it. You can't look around and be in the world and see the world going on around you these days and not hear at least something of politics. And I don't want to stand up here and talk politics from the pulpit right now. That's not the focus of what I want to do. But consider what you hear in politics for a moment. Even when we portray how our system should work, if everybody's a responsible citizen, they're going to go and find what the candidates believe and what their views are and figure out whose views line up with yours and who's going to go represent you. So you think the person who's best choice to govern this country is whoever agrees with you? Whoever is most like you, that is who you need to send, because whoever is going to be most like you is going to be the best person in charge of this country. That's what, even when democracy is working well, that's what we present as a society of, this is how we should go. This is what we should do. Base your decision on pride. That's what we're told. A politician wouldn't survive in the world today if he stood up and said, I don't know what to do about this situation. There's advisors who are much smarter than me who I don't have access to right now. There's classified intel that I have no clue what's going on. I can't tell you what I would do in this situation. I would ask the people who are smart on it. That person would be cast aside as someone with no will, no backbone, somebody who doesn't know what they're talking about. Somebody who doesn't stand up and say, this is what I'm going to do, and then stick to it. If they change their mind later, maybe out of humility because somebody showed them a better way, they're cast aside as a flip-flop or somebody who's not going to stand for what you think. You end up with candidates, the only people people vote for are people as proud as themselves. You end up with pride running against pride, and that's your choice. And that is what we as society teach as the good way for democracy to work. That's the result of the good thing. That's how subtle, yes, we point out how arrogant candidates are sometimes and how they're so prideful, but it's because it's sunk into the theory of how we think it should work. That is pride in our society. You hear it in other things. Somebody being an independent person. That's an independent woman. That is a call for glory to that person. Independence. It's a great word. We have Independence Day. We celebrate our Declaration of Independence. We use those words. Think about what independence means to a person. I have to depend on no one. I take care of myself. I am good to go because I am an independent person. First of all, independence today is a joke. Anybody who's eaten food they bought from a grocery store depended on somebody else to grow it. Nobody is truly independent anymore. That's what grown society. That's what, from the time we had cities, dependence on others is what has helped us grow society. And that's what we see in Acts chapter 4 of the Christians. In Acts 4 and verse 32, it says, Now the multitude of those who believed were of one heart and one soul. Neither did anyone say that any of these of the things he possessed was his own, but they had things in common. Skip down to verse 34 of Acts 4. Nor was there anyone among them who lacked, for all who were possessors of land or houses sold them, and brought the proceeds of things that were sold, and laid them at the apostles' feet, and they distributed to each as anyone had need. These people depended on one another, took care of one another. Lived in dependence with each other. That is how we're called to live. After all, we're ultimately all dependent on God. How can the creation exist without the Creator? Our dependence or independence, none of it matters without Him, because our existence is fundamentally based on our dependence of Him. We're told to depend and rely on Him. Let's go back to 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles chapter 14. In 2 Chronicles 14, that's 1 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles 14, we'll see Asa is the king of Judah. And Asa did a lot of good work. He destroyed some of the previous idols and broke down the high places, and he had done some good work as king of Judah. And let's start in verse 8. And Asa had an army of 300,000 from Judah, who carried shields and spears, and from Benjamin 280,000 men who carried shields and drew bows. All these were mighty men of valor. Then Zerah, the Ethiopian, came out against them with an army of 1,000,000 men and 300 chariots. And he came to Maresha. So Asa went out against him, and they set the troops in battle array in the valley of Zephathah at Maresha. Look here in verse 11 of 2 Chronicles 14. It says, And Asa cried out to the Lord, his God, and said, Lord, it is nothing for you to help, whether with many or with those who have no power. Help us, O Lord, for we rest on you. And in your name we go against this multitude, O Lord. You are our God, Do not let man prevail against you. We rest on you, O Lord. We depend on you. He has, 580,000 men against 1,000,000? Little under 2 to 1, but this says they're all mighty men of valor. Maybe they could pull it out. Maybe Asa has some military genius he could rely on, pull back on, use the terrain to his advantage, funnel the men, let his 300,000 block off something, and his 280 rain arrows into the 1,000,000 men who are now bunched up. Maybe he could do something like that. Maybe he could pull off some military victory. But Asa realizes that's not the point. We rest on you, O God. He puts his dependence of his entire nation on God. And in verse 12, we see the result. So the Lord struck the Ethiopians before Asa and Judah, and the Ethiopians fled. Dependence on God. Dependence on each other. That is God's wisdom. Not independence. People try to raise their kids up so that they can be an independent person in this world and go their own way. They're just instilling them with pride. Pride that is from the world. Pride that is man's way. Pride that leads to destruction. We're so proud in society. Another thing we are above subjection. Subjection is such an ugly word in our society. How, you have to submit to somebody, be subject to somebody. No, that harkens back to the days of slavery. That's too close to slavery. We don't even touch that. Everybody needs to be free of subjection, free of submission. Which, once again, that's all a moot point. Just as we're dependent on God for existence, we're all subject to God. There's nothing we can do about it. Look in Psalms. Psalm 99. Just read verse 1 of Psalm 99. It says, "The Lord reigns. Let the peoples tremble. He dwells between the cherubim. Let the earth be moved." If pride demands that we not be subject, then pride falls. Right here, right at the beginning, right from the start. Because we are subject to God. He is all-powerful, all-knowing. Let the peoples tremble. Let the earth be moved. We have to subject ourselves to God. Otherwise, pride is in the way. Not just God. God goes on in our subjection to God. He demands subjection to others, too. In Romans 13. Romans 13 begins, verse 1. It says, "Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God. And the authorities that exist are appointed by God." You know, we are subject to others as well. The ruling authorities. Our subjection to God leads us to subjection to government. I know Gary mentioned in class this morning, he's surrounded by government workers, and he mentioned how that can be a struggle sometimes. Maybe our government isn't always the best. I'm surrounded by government workers too. I am a government worker. And I have to be subject to those over me. Some of the places we go, we can fly to multiple areas, and some areas we go are pretty pointless. The things we see there, we say, yep, these people still aren't doing anything. I'm a reconnaissance aircraft, that's what we do. We go and we say, yep, they're still not doing anything. We could go a different direction and see lots of stuff, see people doing lots of things, find things that would actually save lives, gathering intel that is impacting people's lives on the ground. We go left and we make a huge impact to people's lives. We go right and we say, yep, these people are still not doing anything. You know, and sometimes my bosses send me right. They send me right. And I have to go out there and I have to fly around. And I could let pride get in the way and be like, well, this is pointless. Let's just go out here, check this box, and get this done and come back. And then we'll go left tomorrow, maybe. I could do that. I could cast it off. I could let my pride get in the way and say, these people above me, they don't know what they're talking about. They're not out here. I'm out here. I'm on the front line. I know what's going on. That's all it is pride, though. When they send me right, I have to go right. And I have to get out there and I have to get the 30 people in the jet behind me who are listening to nothing and tell them that they're doing a good job and keep them listening to it. And we have to sit there and work hard and confirm that, in fact, there is nothing out there. And that is our job. And if we can't do that, it's because of pride. It's the pride in our lives. We think our time is too valuable. We think we know better. We think we should be doing something else. So we're going to teach them a lesson by giving them nothing. Anything we do other than working wholeheartedly with that decision is pride. That's subjection, not subjecting to those over me. We're not just commanded to subject to the authorities. Paul writes in Ephesians 5, he says, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord." You know what? Sometimes us husbands don't know what we're doing. And we do something and go down some road, and the wife sits back and says, "This is going to be bad. This is going to be ugly." Wives, does pride get in your way? And you sit there and you fight that? And now you can advise, yes. But do you sit there and fight once the decision's made and fight to the nail? And when it falls apart, do you sit back and say, "Yep, this is what I knew was going to happen. You're in a bind now, huh, husband?" Or do you subject and say, "You know what? This is how he said we're going to go. This is what he said we're going to do. So I am going to work as hard as I can to make this work. And when it goes wrong, I am going to try to help pick him up and carry him across." Does pride get in the way and keep you from subjecting to your husband, keep you from being the wife you should be? It's pride that drives us out of subjection. It's pride we think we know better. You know what? Maybe if we'd done it your way, we might be better off. We might be worse. We don't know. We're not God. We don't know what would have happened. Hindsight's not 20/20. Saying hindsight's 20/20 is pride. Saying we think we can look back and see if we did something different, we know how it would turn out. What do we know? That's pride too. So cast that aside. Submit. We all have to submit to those people we should be in subjection to. That is a good thing. That is what comes from being in subjection to God. Cast out that pride in your life. People, I know I'm not going to say anything breaking here. People reject God out of pride. Pride is what stands between some people and God. Have you ever heard somebody profess that they just don't know that the Bible can be true because it's so harsh? You know, this doesn't make sense that there's some people, we all were raised, most of us, and then those of us who weren't raised had somebody bring to us the Bible and teach us this message of baptism and how, and we're in a country where it's easy to do that, but there's some people over in other countries, they don't get teachers to come to them. They don't get to be baptized openly. That's just not fair that we have it so much easier that baptism should make a difference. People discard the Bible as being the only way because they don't think it's fair that those people who grew up hearing it and those people who didn't are held to the same standard. It's portrayed as a sense of humility even. It says, "You know what? I know I had this. But I'm humble enough to realize that I was lucky. And so I'm not going to hold this standard to other people because that's not fair. I'm so humble, I'm fair." That's out there. That's common. You hear people say, "I can't trust that this is the only way just because I don't think it's the right way to do it." Notice those people who submit that argument aren't denying a God. They're accepting that there's a supreme being, an all-powerful being who's out there, who created the world, who is right, and we are striving to find a way to him. There's this all-powerful, all-knowing being. But what they say then is, that being couldn't possibly have a different view of fair than me. This is what I view as fair. This is what makes sense to me. So this all-powerful, all-knowing God must think the same way. This humility is really pride. And people turn to it and fall back on it so that they don't even feel like they're casting God aside for bad reasons, for selfish reasons. They feel like they're being the person that, the good person. And all they're doing is relying on pride. They can't set aside their sense of fair, their sense of the way the world works, to acknowledge that they are, as Job, somebody who wasn't there when he created the behemoth, when he created the Leviathan. They can't set that aside and acknowledge who they are. Turn to the book of Habakkuk. Let's look at Habakkuk for a minute. Because Habakkuk, in a way, has one of those moments where he says, God, this doesn't make any sense. This isn't fair. This isn't right. This isn't you. Habakkuk has one of those. Beginning of Habakkuk, he starts by questioning God, saying, how long? Habakkuk looks around and sees unrighteousness ruling over righteousness. He says, how long, God, are you going to let this go unpunished? Judah's living out its last days here. And he says, how long are you going to let this unrighteousness continue? And God tells him in chapter 1, verses 5 and 6, he says, look among the nations and watch. Be utterly astounded, for I will work a work in your days, which you would not believe, though it were told you. For I indeed am raising up the Chaldeans, a bitter and hasty nation, which marches through the earth, the breadth of the earth, to possess dwelling places that are not theirs. And he goes on for a few more verses talking about the Chaldeans. To which, after being answered, saying, how long are you going to let Judah do this, God? After being answered that, well, not much longer, because here come the Babylonians. They're going to wipe them out, this great and terrible nation. Habakkuk goes, whoa, wait, God. Wait, how does that make any sense? Yes, I get it. I just complained about Judah. But these people are way worse. You are righteous. How can you even stand to use these people? You are so righteous. You are so great. Couldn't you do this in a righteous way? You have to use these unrighteous people? You're going to create unrighteousness and make them great? God, this doesn't make any sense. That's what Habakkuk... I am paraphrasing. He doesn't use those... Habakkuk doesn't use those words. But that's the sense of what he's asking God. He's saying, how? This doesn't make any sense. And that's the same thing people are saying when they step back and say, how can the Bible be the way? That doesn't make any sense. That's not fair to the other people. But look at Habakkuk chapter 2 and verse 1. Look at how Habakkuk concludes this second address to God. He says, I will stand my watch and set myself on the rampart and watch to see what he will say to me and what I will answer when I am corrected. How great a stance for someone to say. God, he takes his concerns to God. He says, this doesn't make sense. I don't get it. I wonder what I'm going to say when God corrects me. I wonder what I'm going to think. Such humility. Able to say, this doesn't make sense, but I'm obviously the wrong one. Obviously, the great, all-powerful, all-knowing God isn't constrained by my brain. Obviously, he knows what's going on. So I wait to see what I'm going to say when I'm corrected in this. That is great humility. And humility is the answer to pride. In Luke 11, Jesus tells of a story, well, it's a teaching. He has a teaching, Luke 11, verse 24 through 26. He says, when an unclean spirit goes out of a man, he goes through dry places seeking rest. And finding none, he says, I will return to my house from which I came. And when he comes out, he finds it swept and put in order. Then he goes and takes with him seven other spirits, more wicked than himself. And they enter and dwell there. And the last state of the man is worse than the first. We can't just cast out this evil spirit of pride. We have to fill that, otherwise it returns. We have to fill it. We fill it with humility. Humility and focusing on humility and humbling ourselves is how we drive pride out. I have no time left, but we're going to take some time anyways. Turn over to 2 Kings. Because I want to look at the story of Naaman. And I want to look at Naaman's humility. We talk of Naaman's pride, and yes, he does get tripped up by some pride in there. He gets upset when Elisha doesn't come out to him. He says, what? I'm too good to go dip in the Jordan. There is some pride. But I want to look at Naaman's humility. Because humility is our key to driving it out. And in the end, Naaman does end up cleansed. He goes and dips in the Jordan. So in the end, he drives his pride out. You know, the first point I see when I look for humility in Naaman comes in verse 4-ish. Well, the first four verses. Naaman, the commander of the Syrian army, goes to his lord, meaning the king of Syria. You have Judah, Israel, Syria, Assyria running through along the coast there. What we now have is Israel and Syria and up on into northern Iraq of modern day. So these nations, you know, there's just a few nations there. The king of Syria is his lord. He goes to him on the word of a captive servant girl of his wife's. you know, here's some captive, meaning Naaman could say, who is your God? He let you be taken captive by me. Obviously, my gods are better. He could have pride in his gods. He could take issue that it's coming from a servant girl to his wife. Comes through three chains of servant to servant to wife to him, to the king of Syria. Yet he doesn't discard that and cast it out like a prideful man could do. Now, it could be desperation too. I realize I am supposing some motives in here which we don't have. It could be desperation that he's just taking any word of advice, but then wouldn't he have gone Egypt in the Jordan in the first place? I don't know. I see, at least if it's not his motive, I can see how we can still learn what humility looks like from how he listens to the servant girl. And that's not the only time he listens to a servant. After he rejects the word of Elisha and says, I am too good for this. I am greater than this. Who comes to him to correct him but his servants? In verse 13, it says, and his servants came near him and spoke to him and said, my father, if the prophet had told you to do something great, would you not have done it? How much more than when he says, wash and be clean? His servants come to him and say, oh, you great and powerful man, you're too good for this, huh? Like, First of all, if he wasn't a humble man, would he have servants who would come to him that's wrong? We see Rehoboam, when he gets advice from his advisors that he doesn't like, he goes and finds new advisors. He gets men to tell him what he wants to hear. The fact that he has men around who, one, will speak up and tell him he's wrong, speaks to Naaman. And two, that they do and he listens to them, speaks to Naaman's humility. We see here, he has pride flare up, but he has people who will come to him, who will say, my, aren't you mighty? Are you beneath dipping in the Jordan River? This is what it takes. Why would you not do it? And then he listens. He takes correction, subjects himself to it, and then he goes and dips in the Jordan River, which is even harder now, an even greater act of humility, because he already said he wouldn't. Now he has to go against what he said he wouldn't in his own prideful state, he said he wouldn't do it. He has to turn around and do it, go back on himself, and admit that he's wrong. That makes it even harder to do. Yet he does it. Here is a man who shows humility. He drives that pride out of his life with humility so that he can end up in the Jordan River washed and clean. That is the answer, both for him then and for us now. We can drive pride out of our lives by being dependent on God, being in subjection to God, humbling ourselves before God. Peter wrote in 1 Peter 5, in verse 6, he said, humble yourself. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time. We humble ourselves to God, drives pride out of our lives, and he exalts us at the end of days. I only planned on taking most of my time talking about pride. I've used up all of my time. Plus, I got even more than Jeff normally gets because I got up here earlier than he normally does. So we'll stop there. There are two other things in the world that we can drive out. Perhaps next time I'm standing up here, we'll talk about another one. But humble yourselves before God. Surrender all to him. Set aside your pride. Set aside your cares. Be dependent, be subject to him, and surrender all to God. If there's someone here who has not done that, who has had pride standing between them, who has been like Naaman and said, what? Dipping in the water, that's such a lowly task. I don't need to do that. Put your pride aside. Be like Habakkuk. If you've said, this doesn't make any sense, I don't see how water can matter. Be like Habakkuk and say, I stand waiting to be corrected. Surrender your pride to God. If you've already surrendered that to God, but you are still struggling with pride, renew yourself again. Commit to that humility. Find humility in your life and focus on that. And that will drive that pride from your life. If there's anybody here who has need, Come, surrender all now, while we stand and sing.